Hello and welcome to the Driftstone Podcast. Today I'm literally sitting in Andrew Harris's drift boat, and today we're going to talk about steelheading.
I would say thank you, Andrew, for bringing me out on your boat today. Fish on the Klamath.
My pleasure. Yeah, we picked a pretty nice day to do it, too. So it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the Klamath near Iron Gate. And this is a beautiful day. Like, it could be like September almost. And what we're working on is we're hoping to catch a nice adult steelhead. We're about halfway there. We have caught 5-inch fish. We've caught 10-inch fish. We've caught 12-inch fish. And we're up to about 18 inches now. And hopefully, in the second half of the day, we will move on to catching adult steelhead. Sound good?
Sounds amazing. That's always the dream, right?
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be a great day no matter what. There's still a few salmon here and there in the river that are still spawning, but for the most part, that season is kind of come and gone.
See lots of
carcasses.
Kings on the side.
Yeah.
Or kings, right? Not
kind of... they're, I think they're king salmon, yeah. A lot of carcasses around. A little smelly in certain spots.
For sure.
We're just fishing nymphs and egg imitations and rubber legs. I think the rubber legs might be our best fly so far.
Well, in terms of finding the adults, is that kind of luck or is it just timing them when being in the system or using the right fly? All the things?
It's kind of all of the things. I mean, I feel like any minute, I mean, one thing about steelheading is, you know, they do move around, right? So they're not like resident trout that will just camp out in a spot for months and months. So, you know, if you are fishing 5 miles of river, any spot you roll into all of a sudden can be just full of adult steelhead. And then maybe you catch one or multiple fish in that spot, and maybe you don't catch any anywhere else that day. That's kind of a typical steelhead thing. When it's really good, you catch multiple fish in multiple spots. So
that's kind of where the luck plays in. They just happen to be a lot of them in the system.
Yeah, and so that really puts a premium on moving. So what's weird about steelheading is you can be fishing a perfectly good spot that just looks incredible that has zero steelhead in it. And maybe they'll be there tomorrow or next week, but they might not be there now. So, like, instead of really picking apart every piece of water, it's better to kind of, you know, and changing flies 100 times, it's better to go with some flies that you have confidence in and put them in a lot of spots rather than just really focusing on one or two spots in a day. And that's easily done when we're in the drift boat. We can float 10 miles. It makes it super easy.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, when you're, it just seems like everyone wants this little magic formula, but, you know, do this, go here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just, no matter reading all the best reports with, you know, from the guys that have getting on to fish, you still got to find them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say in general, like steelhead, they can get really trouty. Like if, you know, if they've been in the river for months and months, they can start eating little tiny nymphs. And sometimes there is like a magic fly, you know, but for the most part, they're not super picky on flies.
Okay.
You know, that, I mean, I feel like here in Northern California, there's kind of three food groups that we throw out of flies that we throw out these fish. There's rubber legs, like a size 6 brown or black rubber legs. There are, you know, kind of medium to large trout nymphs, like a copper john or a pheasant tail or a prince or a psycho prince or something like that in a size 12 or 14.
One of the classics.
And then there's egg imitations. So, like, you know, those are your three main things. When you think about it, like a steelhead, it's been out in the ocean. It comes into the river. It's probably literally the stupidest fish anywhere near you if it hasn't been caught yet, right? I mean, any trout that lives in the river is going to be way smarter about what to eat and how to not get caught than the steelhead that just showed up.
Is that just because it's a new habitat or they've got reproducing on their mind?
The last time they were in the river, they were 6 inches long and they've been out eating big things and not being super picky about what they eat in the ocean. And so... that's a, I'd say a way to think about it positively. Like, this is not like a PhD fish here, like on a spring creek that wants a size 24 midge. You know, it's just a fish that's kind of just figuring out what to do in the river again, yet after being out of the river for a long time.
Well, we're at the top of the Klamath, so we're, I don't know maybe how many hundreds of river miles we are from the ocean. Are they more trout-like on this, say this part, than say the lower Klamath?
Yes, they are. So just earlier, like in late September, early October, I was fishing at our spay camp that we set up near the ocean. That's just about 5 miles above tidewater. So I was there for about 10 days. And those fish are, when they come into the ocean, they're fairly aggressive. You know, they'll eat flies that are fished on the swing. They're
still chrome.
They're very chrome. And so we fish them with different techniques. So, you know, it's all spay rod or traditional swing down there. Up here, they do behave a lot more trouty. So we fish them just with nymphs and indicators, just like we would fish for trout on the lower sack. It's very similar. So yeah, I'd say the longer they're in the river, a river system, the more trouty they behave.
Okay. So that can kind of define the characteristics of what that river's steelheading experience is like. So the Trinity's kind of the same way.
Yeah.
I've always heard them described as being kind of trouty there, but maybe places like the Umpqua, they're still pretty chrome, or
yeah,
maybe even the Rogue, but
I think, yeah, just the longer they spend in there, the more technical they might be, and the more they might hang out in water that maybe we wouldn't consider to be traditional steelhead water. You know, maybe more some slower stuff and some deeper water, and maybe not just in the kind of, you know, typical steelhead water like that, you know, walking speed water, riffles and runs. They'll get wedged into little nooks and crannies when they've been in the river for a while, and they start to get some fishing pressure.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that kind of adds to some of the confusion about even the difference between a rainbow and a steelhead, because, like, you know, if they've been in this river for 500 miles or in terms of time,
yeah,
that may be, you know, a couple months, whatever.
Several months.
They get their rainbow color back. It looks like a rainbow. They're feeling like it's rainbow. I mean, it's just a big rainbow, right? I mean, in some ways it is, but they're definitely genetically different. So, well, are they the same?
Well,
genetically, I don't remember.
Well, through our Trout Unlimited chapter in Redding, the Shasta Trinity Cascades chapter, we assisted with some sampling with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, where they sampled fish from some of the local streams. And so what they found is a certain percentage of the fish, of the rainbow trout that are in any of these streams where they have access to the ocean, a certain percentage of them go to the ocean. Now, in some rivers or some streams, it's like close to 100%. And some, it's very low. And the in Northern California, the reason for that is, you know, the streams that have a lot to offer the fish stay put. Like, they grow up in the river. And what they saw is, like, some of the, through scale analysis, they, you know, on captured fish, like bigger fish, they could tell that basically this fish went out to the ocean when it was tiny, like under 10 inches, and it did that once and it never did it again because the environment in the river was just way better. Yeah. Yeah.
You might see that in places like Redding, a lot of residents.
Right.
They get pretty big.
Yeah, those fish have no I mean, some of them still do go to the ocean, but most of them are going to stay put because they have tons of food.
Right.
Whereas some of the fish that came from streams that are more high gradient, not as much, you know, not as many nutrients and invertebrates to eat, a high percentage of fish from streams like that become steelhead.
That makes sense. I hadn't really considered the shape of the river and its gradient.
Yeah, kind of the productivity of the river. Like, yeah, if there's plenty to eat, they might go to the ocean, assuming they have some access to
it. Yeah. I think about the story of the Elwha, which I think before the Klamath dams come out was the largest dam removal project in the country. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that the rainbows in the reservoir above, I guess by they were wild at that point, mm-hmm. at least not freshly from a hatchery.
Right.
The second the dam came out, they all went to the ocean and became steelhead.
Wow.
Like they all had those instincts still. So it's just pretty fascinating. So that brings us back to where we are. Like, this is a big question mark. I mean, they've got all these dreams of, you know, what to restore this river system by removing these dams.
Right.
This river does get pretty hot in the summer months.
It gets.
The water temps rise a lot.
And the water quality is really gross.
Right. Well, it's got those parasites that kill the salmon, and they're not good for people or dogs too, right?
Yeah. And I mean, in the middle of the summer, you can just look at the water and the color of it's bad and it smells bad. And so hopefully that won't be the case as much.
Right. So we're here fall 2023, and they're going to start draining them, I think, in the spring, and then the dams will come out the following season. But basically, this river will be restored in the spring to its original path, and it's pretty exciting. Kind of fun to sit by and watch and see how it changes.
Yeah. I mean, right, historically with the dam, I mean, one of the reasons we're fishing right here is because these steelhead get kind of stacked up below Iron Gate Dam. And so, you know, that's a big question mark.
When
they can go farther up, I mean, this stretch will certainly still be productive, but how far up will the fish go? You know, where will we be fishing for them in 10 years? That's a really interesting question. There's going to be new accesses, new sections of the river that we can float or wade. There's going to be new public accesses put in. It'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, the two remaining dams that they're leaving in have fish ladders. So some of the big questions I've heard are, will the salmon go all the way up into the Klamath Basin, spawn again? And then those big red bands they've got up there that don't leave, will they leave?
Yeah, so right.
That'll be interesting to see how that all pans out.
Yeah, because the locals up there, I'll say that those fish behave a lot like steelhead. And who knows what they'll do.
The Klamath is an interesting watershed because the basin, the main lake, is very shallow. So,
yeah.
I mean, it generates a lot of heat in the summer. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
Even if they took out the Keno Dam, I think that would still be the case. Because is it a natural dam? I can't remember. Or lake? The Klamath?
Klamath Lake has a small dam at the bottom.
The Link River?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. At the head of the Link River.
Okay. Well, even so, it's a shallow watershed that's fed by all those spring
creeks.
Like ice cold all year. So I think we're talking about them acting like steelhead. They'll be in the lake during the winter months and then move into the colder water. Is that kind of my understanding?
Well, currently they move into the tributaries in the summer when the lake gets really hot.
I had it backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
This all plays out.
Things are going to change. It'll be really interesting to see.
For sure. Well, is there any, when you talk about those three food groups for targeting steelhead, do you like to mix it up and use all of them to find out what they're keyed into, or
how do you decide? Yeah, I mean, I think one hint that if you're new to steelheading, like, you know, when the water is crystal clear, you know, typically the fish like to eat nymphs. You know, when it's more off color, you know, that steelhead green we all like to see, then that's when the egg imitations typically work better. That's a good place to start. And, you know, of course, if there are salmon actively spawning, that's usually a pretty good sign that you can fish some egg imitations with some confidence.
We were talking about before we started recording that rainbows are just kind of, or trout in general, are programmed to eat eggs.
Yeah.
So it's whether or not they work great or they're just kind of average.
Yeah, like you could fish pretty much anywhere where there's trout. You could fish a trout egg imitation or a salmon egg imitation. And it'll always work some. Maybe less so if there's a huge hatch of insects. But at times when there's salmon spawning around, then it works really well.
Sure.
But they can work surprisingly well even in the absence of that.
Okay.
Hundreds of people have been tying their flies with Driftstone slotted tungsten beads now, and it's unanimous. They're the best. They've got the tightest slots in the industry, so they're heavier and you need fewer thread wraps to lock them in. Tie faster and save money because our 50 packs are the best value out there. If you're not a tier, that's okay. You can pick up my favorite patterns hand-tied by me using the same exact beads. Check them out and more at driftstone.co.
You mentioned to sort of bring spay into this. The fish that are closer to the ocean are still more aggressive. And why does spay work better in those circumstances?
So if you think of a fish that's behaving a little bit more like a trout, maybe it wants to eat something that's kind of just dead drifted, you know, like an insect. And so that's with our trout spay rods, if we're fishing a traditional swing, that's a little harder for us to imitate. The steelhead, when they first come into the rivers, they're a little bit more open to suggestion. They don't just need to eat something that's been dead drifted right into their mouth, right? So, and also like the character of the water up here, you know, it's a very bouldery river. I've seen about three or four really nice places to swing a fly on this float today. But most of it's kind of a lot of bedrock, a lot of pocket water. Not really prime swing water, in my opinion. The farther down you go, like this afternoon, we'll see there are three or four really nice swing runs on the water we'll be on this afternoon. And the farther down you go, there's just more and more and more of it. So part of it's what the fish is interested in eating, and part of it is the water type. If you take the big, broad riffles and runs and tailouts on the middle and lower Klamath, they're just well suited to being fished with a spay rod because you can effectively cover a lot of water, you know, making those long casts and long presentations. A lot of that water would be actually really hard and kind of monotonous to try if you were to try to like indicate or nymph some of that water. I mean, because the runs are so broad and...
Well, it's like no clear seams or...
Right. It's like, you know, you would have to fish your arm off really to cover that water effectively with a nymph and an indicator. So water type and the fish's tendencies on, you know, how much they want to move to the fly, those two things will tell you maybe what technique you should be using.
Is the old adage, you know, it takes 1,000 casts to catch your first, or any steelhead, is that more linked to the spay casting? Or is that just an old wives' tale?
No, I'd say that's a fairly useful saying. You know, you do have to pay a lot of dues when you're steelheading, a lot of fruitless casts. I would say if we're on a river where there's a lot of fish, you're definitely going to catch more with an nymph and an indicator.
Okay.
You know, I joke around and tell people who, you know, they're like, oh, I'm kind of getting interested in spay casting or whatever. And I mean, keep in mind, you know, usually when I go out and I am wade fishing for steelhead on my own, that's about all I ever do is spay cast. Okay. So keep in mind where I'm coming from, but I will jokingly tell people, you know, when you get absolutely sick of catching fish and too many fish, too many steelhead, then let's take up some spay casting, okay. Right? So,
is that just because it's that presentation is not quite as natural what a bug would do? Or, I mean, you can swing eggs, can you? Or
yeah, you could swing any kind of
right.
fly.
So,
what is
it about it that makes it more difficult?
Well, it's actually easier in a lot of ways. I think again, it's the dead drift thing, and just being able to feed a fish that's not necessarily like in a super feeding mood. It's still going to eat your fly if it just floats straight into its face, right?
Got it.
So we can almost force feed the fish a fly if we're nymph and indicator fishing. So, I will say, like, I'll get done with some, like, slow indicator nymphing trips, like where we really fished hard and like maybe hooked one fish and that's all we got. And I'm like, at the end of a day like that, we've basically set the hook 300 times on rocks.
Right.
Because you have to fish close to the bottom when you're nymph and indicator fishing to catch steelhead. So basically, I felt like we set the hook 300 times on rocks, and one time we hooked a fish, and I'm like, this is the dumbest possible way to fish. That's how I feel on a day like that. But then the next day, you might go out and you might hook 10, you know? So,
well, that's fishing, right?
Yeah, it is.
In general.
But like, you know, just on that slow day of indicator nymphing, it's kind of agonizing, just like, oh my gosh, we just, all we did was set the hook on nothing all day and had one opportunity. So I think spey casting is my preferred way to fish for these when I'm fishing for myself. It's not for everyone. Like, you kind of either get it or you don't. Like, if you're, some people just start, won't let go of, well, it just doesn't catch as many fish, like, and they're right. And so, like, then it's just not for them. And no big deal. Like, it's not for everybody. That's the neat thing about fly fishing is, like, it's kind of a bottomless pit. You never get to the end of it. And you get to decide what kind of fishing you like to do. And so for some people, all they do all the time is, like, small stream, dry dropper, you know, dry flies, like that's, to them, that is fly fishing. And then other people, it's like the most, the biggest all the time. Like that's whatever technique I've got to do to get the most and the biggest, that's all I'm going to do. And some, you know, some people are into weird niche, you know, techniques and all kinds of things. There's no wrong answer. Right. So like everybody gets to figure out what they like about fly fishing and how to catch these fish and, or, you know, how to get humiliated by these fish at times. And yeah,
I think
it's fun.
It is, for sure. I just connected with this guy from the UK through the YouTube channel, and he was making a comment. It was my Idaho video where I was dry dropper fishing and catching them on dries. And he's like, I just like to see the American who's not fishing a streamer. And I'm like, really? I didn't know that Americans had a reputation for
that. That's what we do, huh? I didn't know that.
I asked him for more, you know, detail on that. And a lot of the rivers in the UK are dry fly only. Like, they're very restrictive there.
So they associate us with dirty methods.
I guess. Maybe it seems unsportsmanlike to them. I don't know. I mean, that's highly based on their
rivers. Non-upstream dry fly fishing.
Yeah, they'll use them a lot in lakes, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
They call them lures, I guess. They don't call them streamers there. But that kind of stuff, it's kind of part of the elitism that kind of goes through our sport.
Right.
Where people are, I'm only fly fishing if I'm using dry flies or whatever.
Right.
I mean, even for when Kelly Gallup's book came out for streamers, I mean, streamers weren't really widely accepted back then. And that's obviously changed now. Streamers are a big part of the sport. But
right.
All that to say, it's just funny how, I mean, you can, like you said, I recently went out with you to do some trout spay and we're like, oh, this is different and fun. And it may not be as productive, but it's just, it's new. It's a new thing, a skill to develop. And expand your tools and your tool chest.
Right. And if you enjoyed it after that day, which was literally like the slowest and least productive day of trout spay I've ever had. If you liked it, then I think you actually have a promising future in spay casting.
Oh, that's
because it only gets better from there.
Okay. Well, good.
Great day. It was a great instructional day.
Right. Well, that's what I did.
Right. So,
kind of also talking about biology of the fish and what makes a steelhead versus a rainbow. I mean, trout are multi-spawners. They'll come back, they'll spawn and potentially go back to the ocean again and live out their life. A salmon generally, when they're spawning in the river, they're not eating anymore. It's usually they'll eat for different reasons, not dietary.
Right.
Are trout the same way? Or, I mean, you mentioned they'll eat it if it's opportunistically right in front of their nose, but
the steelhead definitely like go out of their way to eat things.
Okay.
You might argue that maybe they're attacking things or just seeing what things are by grabbing them. And I think both the salmon do occasionally do the same thing. On the Trinity, we catch a fair number of salmon on dead drifted nymphs. And I think what's going on is, I mean, they all those fish grew up in the river eating little invertebrates and other things. And so I think they probably just get back into the remember and just remember that and do it out of habit.
Yeah.
You know, that's how they got to be 6 inches long before they went to the ocean, is just eating little nymphs. So I think it's just a reflex.
Okay. So it's not something you can, I don't know, I guess it probably doesn't really matter when you're choosing what kind of fly to put on to start thinking about what they're eating.
Yeah.
Like a hatch.
Sometimes the fish do seem to eat things that like you would never see in the wild, like a bright green nymph or, you know, a hot pink
neon
nymph.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And other times it's like they are eating the thing that's hatching, like they might eat a very tiny betis nymph or something like that. So it's a little bit of both. I mean, I've seen both happen.
Right on.
And I've seen steelhead eat just some totally ridiculous flies that no trout should ever eat, you know, but steelhead will eat them.
Right.
Like just like the worst looking fly you see.
Steelhead flies often have an orange bead on them or some weird nonsense like that. Or
They'll have chartreuse colors or hot pink or, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting traditional steelhead flies. And, there's egg-sucking leeches that are, it's kind of a ridiculous-looking fly, but steelhead eat those too.
And you're not personally kind of religious about that kind of thing?
And no. I feed them all kinds of things.
There's no bottom-dragging flies for you that, you know, I would never fish that fly.
No.
You know,
well, I'm a little like hesitant on the squirmy worm.
Are you? Why?
I don't like how when the fly box gets hot, they like melt in my fly box.
True.
So that.
Well, that's a different reason.
Yeah, I know.
But it's not beneath you.
I may have tied one on. I may have tied one on before.
I personally
not my favorite.
I personally don't have much confidence in them. I mean, they work sometimes. Yeah. They're not like some magic bullet. I think.
I've seen that. At times, guides swear by them for steelhead, but I've not been bitten by the squirmy worm bug yet.
No, there's always tomorrow. Well, you're still fishing a lot of traditional stuff that people have moved on from, like princes, and I mean, I know they're still used.
Oh, right. So if you wait long enough, if they've been out of fashion for long enough, they work.
I think they're kind of coming back though. That's like right. I heard some discussions from some fly tires that are like, well. What's old is new again. And
yeah, that's right.
One that believes that the fish might get, quote unquote, burnt out on seeing certain kinds of flies.
Well, it was funny, you know, when we, on the lower sack, when the guide community really started fishing the jig hook nymphs, the Perdigon style stuff, you know, several years ago, it was like magic. And I swear you could not catch a fish on anything else.
Okay.
And it was like, I felt like for me, it was like that for about 3 years. And I feel like now you can actually catch a fish on like a normal, quote unquote, normal non-jig hook fly again. But I felt like for a while they were just like trained.
You wouldn't know. I mean,
they were trained to eat those things. It was crazy.
Really? Huh.
And they still like them, but I feel like now like all of the flies that I used to go through a lot 10 years ago work again now. So.
Well, I think guides are definitely one of the unique people that can sort of see those patterns, because even, I mean, I fish, I don't know, 75 days a year, quite a lot, more than most weekend warriors, and I don't really see those kinds of patterns. Maybe I'm not good enough at seeing them, but I think if you're going out regularly with clients and you see these flies start to work and those don't.
When you have two dudes in your boat and they both have three flies on, you can sample a lot of flies.
Good point. That's a good point. Well, and you have other guys in your crew.
Oh, yeah. Reporting
back to each other.
Yep. Always completely honestly, of course.
Oh, so there's some gamesmanship there?
Yeah, there might be.
Even in your own company?
Usually it's just me asking the guides what works because they're actually out there. And I'm not out there very much. So I'm always picking their brains.
That's funny. So they're at like, well, the fly shop's recommending peaches and cream. Don't use that.
The trick is to go in there and look at... which boxes are empty. Those are usually the flies that are getting snatched up by the guides.
Okay, interesting. I never really thought of that, but that makes sense.
Good fly buying advice right there. The one that is chock full, it's probably not full.
What if it's like the rubber legs bin that's got 1,000 in there?
Well, that could be.
Well, I had a buddy who he swore that rubber legs did not work. I'm like, are you kidding me? He's all, no, I've never caught a fish on one. I'm like, let's go out right now.
Yeah.
And we went out, caught some fish on some rubber legs and got him some confidence.
Yeah.
It's funny how that confidence can weigh into the flies you choose.
Well, and I think there's a flip side to that for beginners, which is sometimes just by sheer accident, when you're a beginner, you might tie on just a ridiculous fly, or you're fishing just in kind of a strange manner and you catch a fish, and then that is like your go-to fly and technique, and you shouldn't have caught that fish. It was just like a fluke, right? Now that's what you do, and that's your jam. So I think that happens a lot.
For sure.
Yeah, fish are funny creatures, and you know, but sometimes you get a fish when you're not doing it right. Sometimes that's how you discover a whole new thing, you know, that is really effective.
Well, I think that's, for me, the puzzle of fly fishing. There's just so many variables. Every day you go out, so many things can change from day to day. And I mean, I've had so many experiences where I've had 2 days back to back, weather didn't change, nothing seems to change, but the flies on day one did not work on day two.
Right.
And I don't know if it's because I suck them the day before or what, but
yeah,
those kind of puzzles are super intriguing.
Let me know when you figure that one out.
Well, I'll sell it for $1 million.
That's right.
On that point, though, I think a lot of anglers will attribute. They'll see something and say that's the reason why it happened.
Yeah.
And there might have been that plus four or five other factors.
Right. Yeah.
It's just so hard to draw conclusive, I think, opinions on things.
It is. Yeah. There's
definitely some guesswork, some luck, but I mean, I think a lot of it's mostly good drifts.
Yeah.
And getting out there and just doing it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to just having good technical skills when you're fishing, and that accounts for most of it, you know, and then you add fly selection into that. And now we're into, there's a million variables right there.
The sun's high, the sun's low, the water temp, the weather. How about this one? I have not got a firm answer on barometric pressure. How does it affect the fish?
It does. So in trout world, I would say trout really, they like a stable barometer. Usually when it's changing rapidly, they're not happy.
Up or down?
I feel like the change they don't like so much. Once it's changed rapidly and kind of stabilized into like a different, you know, higher or lower, then they get happy again. I just feel like that they're usually not too grabby on the change. That might just be a Northern California thing.
That's kind of an old fisherman knowledge thing. Like whenever there's a storm rolling in,
yeah,
the bite turns off. But once the storm's here,
it's on.
It's better.
Yeah, that's, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of hours then? Is that hard to put a number on?
Usually it's like, if it sucks now, it's going to suck all day. Like during that
transition,
that barometric change. Yeah. Oh.
And is that related to the swim bladders or?
I don't know. I have no idea. The other thing, like
the bug life, maybe
the other thing that really affects our fishing, like on the lower Sacramento River, windy days, it's very rare to have like a banner fishing day on a windy day. Like a seriously windy day.
Because that hurts your presentations?
Even when you are getting a good presentation, it just seems like the fish just aren't as into it.
Then like a spring creek that's blowing terrestrials into the water, and that could be a banner day.
Right, yeah. And you might find whenever you're on a stream like that, the wind's never blowing. Like, it's not,
yeah, it seems like that, huh?
When you want it to blow, it's going to be dead calm. It's just one of those Murphy's Law of fly fishing.
Huh. I hadn't heard that one on the sack. That's interesting.
Yeah. Usually, yeah, that the windy days, because even when you're getting that good drift, it's just like they're not as into it. Now, you take that windy day on a lake, usually that is
right.
Good for the fishing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's breaking the water surface.
Yeah.
I agree. Interesting. Well, I think we've covered quite a bit. I think that was super insightful. Let's, we are literally sitting in the boat as we've recorded.
That's right. That's
so
right.
We need to get back at it. And
maybe, yeah. We're going to catch that adult steelhead.
I think we will.
All right.
I'm feeling it. Well, okay. Thanks, Andrew.
All right. You're welcome.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast with Andrew. I hope you learned something. I know I sure did. There's just so much to talk about with steelheading, and we just scratched the surface with this, obviously. But if you'd like to book a trip with Andrew or one of his guides who are super knowledgeable, I don't think they actually have a trip or a guide that'll run the Klamath, but if you want to do the Trinity or Upper Sac or any number of places in the North State, definitely look up Confluence Outfitters and give them a call. Tell them I sent you. If you watched or listened to this on YouTube, please consider liking the video and subscribing so you don't miss out on this and all the videos to come. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider leaving a 5-star review because those reviews make a huge difference in how the show gets promoted. So thanks again. Until next time, everybody, I'll see you on the water. Godspeed.